Today's sponsor is Audible.com, which has more than 180,000 audiobooks and spoken word audio products. We have a special offer for undisclosed listeners. You can get a free 30-day trial at www.audible.com/undisclosed. Again, that's www.audible.com/undisclosed. This week's episode is also brought to you by Stamps.com. Mailing and shipping can seem like a no-win situation. The post office takes too much time, and a postage meter is too expensive. Fortunately, there's a better way, Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You'll get a 4-week trial and $110 in bonuses, including postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in UNDISCLOSED. That's Stamps.com. Enter UNDISCLOSED. Every week, you hear us read great ads for companies like Stamps.com. These ads work because you know we wouldn't tell you to buy something we didn't believe in. And then listeners like you actually go and buy these products. This is a win for everybody. And your company can be a winner too, just by advertising on this podcast. The company that books our ads is called Midroll. Because of them, we can focus on efforts on making a great show. They also take good care of our advertisers with excellent customer service. Check out their website at midroll.com/undisclosed. And then click contact to let them know you're interested in advertising on Undisclosed. They represent a bunch of other great shows like Truth and Justice Podcast and Star Talk. That's midroll.com/undisclosed, midroll.com/undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. Today's episode is part two of Post-Conviction Relief. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. And I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an attorney at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs The View from LL2.com. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor and blogger at the Evidence Prof blog. Last we left off, Asia McClain had done pretty well on direct examination by Justin Brown. But now she's going to be subjected to cross-examination by the state. And not just by any attorney, but by the Deputy Attorney General of Maryland, Thiru Vignaraja. Now, holding up under cross-examination is no easy thing to begin with for anybody. But for Asia, it was made harder because, well, she was a long way from home. Having come from all the way across the country, she was under intense media scrutiny. And she left all her kids behind. Also, she was expecting a new child. But having stood by her statements for nearly 17 years, Asia is about to find every single thing she ever said challenged, and challenged hard. So the state's cross-examination of Asia began with this really interesting exchange, and I'm just going to read directly from Susan's notes. Question. How are you? Answer, nervous. Question, still nervous? Answer, yeah. Question, we'll be gentle. Now, the exchange was, I think it sounded a little bit creepy at the time. I'm sure it sounds a little bit creepy now, but I think this was Thiru's way of getting Asia to relax a bit. She was nervous and she was getting ready to be cross-examined. And she probably did need to relax because he does come at her pretty hard for the next few hours.
Well, he started off trying to, you know, be the good guy, come at her as if he was, you know, oh, I'm sorry, Asia, thank you for being here, but it just sounds like your memory is definitely not January 13th. And he did seem more sympathetic at the very beginning. I mean, he definitely built up towards his accusations against her. But in the beginning, his approach really was sort of a, we're all friends here. Let's just, you know, show why you're remembering the wrong day.
Well, can I ask you about this next exchange that you have in your notes, which, like, the context, I don't understand. And this is a question that the prosecutor is asking her about cereal. And by the way, for folks who did not know, Sarah Koenig was actually there for the first 3 days of the hearing. So the prosecutor asks Asia, cereal's pretty good, right? And she says, yes. And then he says, Sarah Koenig's good at what she does, right? And she says, yes. And then he says, it's entertainment, right? And she says, yes. What was the point of that?
He was trying to get across that whatever she'd heard in Serial wasn't true, that it was just a story. It was entertainment. he asked a couple more questions, I think, that I didn't get down. But the whole series of questions was aimed at getting out that Zero really was just this work of fiction, and that Sarah Koenig was really good at putting together this entertaining fictional story. It didn't really go anywhere else, but that's what he wanted to open with.
It's interesting because I think Asia really didn't care too much about the story in and of itself. I think she was mostly concerned about Eric's comments in that story.
Yeah, she was talking about how she finally did listen to Serial, and she made her husband sit there with her as they binge listened through all of it.
I want to know if she's listened to Undisclosed.
Probably I don't think not. So. She didn't really seem to be, well, we'll get into it later, but Thiru tried to ding her for the fact that she hadn't read all the transcripts and hadn't researched the case. And was using that as a point against her.
That's not a good strategy, but...
That's the opposite of what you'd expect, because the fact that she is a little bit more lacking in knowledge about the case should be helpful in terms of her independent recollection.
That's exactly my impression at the time. I was trying to figure out where he was going with the questions, and when I realized that, I was kind of taken aback, because his tone was very much, wait, so you're saying you haven't read all the transcripts? You're saying you haven't looked into this case beyond Serial? You haven't tried to find out the truth outside of what Serial presented? And as far as I'm concerned, that was a great point in her favor.
But, you know, it could have been basically the same thing Yurik was trying to convey to her, which is you have no idea what else exists that overwhelms what you have to offer, right? Like, there's this overwhelming evidence that you don't even know exists. Maybe that's what he was trying to do, but doing it on the stand, maybe it's not the best idea.
Yeah, her response was, I live across the country. I don't even know how I'd get the transcripts from the court. So she didn't even know the transcripts were available online. She thought he was asking her why she hadn't gone to the courthouse, pulled out the transcripts, and read them. Anyway, he came back to the actual point of her testimony, and they said, one reason you came forward was to do the right thing to make sure the truth came out. Answer, correct. Question, even back in 99? Answer, yes. And then Asia went on to explain that she went to the defendant's house because she had information that she knew could be helpful and wanted to make sure that the defendant's family knew it. There was also discussion about how she found out about Adnan's arrest. She said that she didn't remember if it was in person that she found out or on a phone call, but very shortly after she found out, she got in touch with Justin Adger.
Justin Adger, for those of you who might not remember, was actually Asia's ex-boyfriend at the time, and he was a good friend of Adnan's. And I mentioned in last week's episode that when Adnan had seen Asia, he was thinking, because he had met her boyfriend, that, oh, I'm going to like tease Justin and say that I saw her with her new man. So anyhow, so Asia calls Justin that day or somehow connects with Justin and finds out about Adnan's arrest.
And at some point, it was agreed that Justin would pick up Asia and take her to Adnan's family's house. So she says that she doesn't know when, but it was March 1st in the evening, about to get dark. He picks her up. They go to Adnan's family's place. It's very crowded. There's people everywhere. It's because they've all come back from the bail hearing that day. So Thiru started asking her, who all did you tell about this? And she said she told Justin about it. And then the following day, she told Mr. Parker, her Spanish teacher, but she didn't really remember telling anyone else about it. So Thiru tries to take a, oh, so this was a secret, or you were embarrassed about it, or so you were apprehensive about telling others? And Asia said, no, I just think that's just how it happened. We then get into a series of questions about when the second letter was written. So just to, you know, recap, if anyone needs it at this point, there are two letters from Asia. The first is a handwritten letter written on March 1st. The second is a typed letter written on March 2nd. The second letter says, I want you to know that I'm missing the instructions of Mrs. Ogle's CIP class writing this letter. So the arrest, this letter was written in CIP. And Asia said, maybe. Well, based on the letter, that's what I remember. And Thiru asked this question about three times, and Justin starts objecting, asked and answered, because you cannot ask a question multiple times, because it's too easy to get a witness to start giving inconsistent answers if you ask them the same thing 100 times. So typically you're not allowed to do it. But in this case, it was being allowed. So Asia has to say about three times, well, I don't remember where I was, but based on the letter, I'm in CIP. And at some point, Justin objected. I think his actual objection was badgering. And I couldn't get what the judge said, but he did tell Thiru to try and move on. And then Thiru starts to hit her more. Like, so when was Spanish class? When was CIP class? When did you write this letter? And then he quotes the letter and says, anyway, have to go to third period. So you were writing in second period? Thiru asked her. And Asia said, well, apparently the said third was next. Again, more asked and answered, and Theo tries to get a response from her. What he's trying to get at is that Asia didn't have any classes during the third period slot at this time period, and that therefore somehow something. But Asia's schedule was the same at all relevant points from January to her graduation. So if he was trying to make the point that this letter was written not on March 2nd, well, there's not really any logic to that, because that wouldn't explain anything.
I think what he was trying to get at was, you know, Asia had said that she was in a kind of a work study program where she let her classes wrapped up early and then she would go to work for the rest of the day. Is that what he was getting at? Because I remember Krista was at, I think, the very last day of the hearing, and she mentioned something to me that the schedules actually at some point between January 13th and March 1st actually did change for them again. So it might very well have been that Asia was back in regular classes at that point.
He was not being very clear what he was getting after. And I didn't realize at first, and Asia clearly didn't realize at first either, because she was answering in a way that said, that's what the letter says, yes. And I'm not even clear if she ever realized that Theo was trying to score points against her there, because to her, it seemed like a non-issue. She's like, well, obviously, if it says I have to go to third period, it means I was in second period and that class was ending when I wrote it. But then he tried to trip her up and say, oh, but your Spanish class was second period and CIP was first period, right? And she said, well, I don't remember what my schedule was my high school year. And he did like kind of like a aha moment. But I mean, do any of y'all recall your schedules for your senior year of high school?
I don't know what I was doing yesterday.
I don't know my class schedule from last year. I don't remember my law school schedule from much more recently. Yeah, I mean, it's there's a case that I wrote about recently on my blog, the Walker case out of South Carolina, and it involved an alibi witness testifying, you know, over a decade later, just like Asia McLean. And even details about the actual alibi itself, the court recognized, well, it makes sense that that would be foggy. And to say a second letter that she wrote to a nun in prison and not knowing the exact details of when it was written or your class schedule, I mean, that just, it's so collateral to any material issue at the hearing. It's barely even worth mentioning, I would say.
Did Theroux have any proof that her first period was CIP and second period was Spanish? I mean, or was he just throwing that out there? Because it seemed, at least for the little portion that I saw later, that he sometimes would just kind of make up things and see if they stuck. And so did he actually have a schedule to show her? Or
I was wondering that. I was wondering if she was, if she had committed, well, yes, definitely CIP was first period and Spanish was second period, if he was going to whip out a schedule and be like, aha, your schedule says the opposite. But since she was pretty clear that, you know, I think I had Spanish and CIP or something, he felt like he wasn't going to need to confirm it. But then again, based on everything else that happened during the hearing, in hindsight, it's probably most likely he had no schedule whatsoever, and he was just kind of throwing it out there.
And again, what even is the point? Clearly, she wrote the letter. Clearly, that was her belief as to the schedule. I just don't see how her being confused as to if she even was confused about the schedule would make any difference whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, when he is grilling her on this whole, when is Spanish, when is CIP, Asia said, to be honest with you, I don't even know what CIP stands for. I do remember Mrs. Ogle's voice, though. That you wouldn't forget. At this point, up until now, Theory was much more friendly towards her. He was being very much like, this witness just has a bad memory and she got everything wrong. And this is when it started to turn the other way. He asked her, so when'd you mail these letters? And she said, could have been the next day, could have been next week. And then Theo cuts her off. I'm sorry, but I have to ask, is it possible you could have mailed the letter a month later? And Asia said, no, I mailed it shortly after. I don't know exactly when, but it was shortly after. And then Theo hits that a few times, and he talks about when did Anand receive the letter, and he says, does Anand's testimony about receiving the letter within a week of his arrest sound right? And Asia said, I guess it sounds right. I mean, I don't know how long the jail mail system takes. It was a good response, because Theo kept trying to have the sort of gotcha moments, as if Asia would know exactly how long it would take for the mail to be processed at the jail where he was at the time, and she just kept answering very reasonably. Well, that sounds right. I don't know how they handle jail mail there.
I think I saw a tweet that Asia responded to one question by saying, I don't know, I've never been in jail, which seemed like the appropriate response.
Yeah, I mean, why would she know that? And then at some point she explains that she wrote the letter in class by hand and then later that evening went home and typed it. So yeah, it then went back again for a while about Asia's schedule. She said that in the morning, she usually took the school bus to school, but because she'd finished all the classes she needed for college, she was permitted to do continuing education, or CE. And she had the same schedule at school from January to graduation, but what she did after getting out for CE changed. She had different jobs, she did different things, but she didn't usually go to the library after getting out of class in the mornings, but she did go there sometimes to meet Jared. She said eventually, actually, what she would do is in the morning, she'd get a ride from her place to Jared's place and then drive his car to school. So she'd have his car there and wouldn't have to wait for a ride when she got out. But at the time this all happened, she and Jared hadn't been dating that long. So she wasn't spending all of her time with him like that and wasn't taking his car to school in the mornings.
That's interesting because I didn't notice that in the social media discussion, but I think that's actually very helpful that she wasn't going to the library on a daily basis, meaning that this was more of a singular event that might stand out as opposed to her possibly confusing it with another day.
Yeah, she had good reasons for why she was recalling this day and why she was sure it was that day. And that could have been, again, why Thiru started to much more heavily pound the this is all a scheme, this is all a plot. You intentionally fabricated an alibi thing because she was standing up so well to the, oh, your memory's mistaken line of attack. So then he started talking about sports and activities. And I don't know where he got this from. I don't know if he had some information or if he was just going off a hunch, but he started asking what sports she played. And he said, did you do any spring activities? She said, I don't think so. Oh, I did play volleyball and basketball, but those are winter sports. And Theo latched onto that, and I did too, because I was surprised to hear her say what she said next. And he asked, did you play basketball your senior year? And she said, well, yes. And he said, did you ever get kicked off the team? Did you quit? Did you play and not get kicked off the team the whole season? And she said, no, I didn't. I didn't get kicked off. And she explained she was not a good player. She'd started off being a cheerleader for the team and then migrated to being a player, but she wasn't very good at all. And Theo asked again and again, so did you have basketball on January 13th? And Asia said, well, no, by the time I was doing CE, I didn't have any sports anymore. Basketball was a winter sport. I think it was over at that time. And he asked her if that's why in one of her letters, she says for Anand to call her between 1 and 4 or after 8:45. And she says, I don't think so, because there was no sports at that time. What Thier was getting at was that, well, actually, basketball did play in January. And in fact, they had a game the very day that Hay went missing. So if Asia was on the basketball team, well, she wouldn't have been in the library because they had a game at Parkville at 6:30 that day.
And that should ring some bells for you guys, because if you remember, there was somebody who's part of the story who had a game that night, and that was Stephanie. So we know that Stephanie was at a basketball game that same evening, and then Jay apparently had gone to see her afterwards for her birthday.
Yeah, and we know they left the school about 3:45, I think. So why would she be trying to leave the school at around 2:30 if that was the case? Anyway, that was still the first day of the PCR hearing. And Thiru ended his cross-examination. And I think it was because he wanted to prepare for the kill shot on this basketball thing. So I think he wanted to get out of the cross so he could come back tomorrow completely prepared and be like, aha, I figured you out. You were at a basketball game that day, not in the library. But he ended with a few quick questions saying, did you ever talk to Anand after his arrest? She said, no, never again. Did you ever go back to see his family? No. His last question concerned the part of her letter. It says that Anand had trouble accounting for his day from 2:15 to 8 p.m. And he tried to score a few points on that and then asked her, so when did the mosque start? And she said, well, I assume 8 p.m. because that's when I put in the letter. I don't know what point he was trying to score, but he cut it off then and it was agreed that they'd resume the cross tomorrow. Theo starts off the cross on day 2 and says, yesterday evening, your attorney contacted me and indicated that you wanted to clarify a few matters. The first was that, because in one of the questions Theo had asked or something, he'd implied or said that Justin's defense investigator back in 2010 had knocked on her door to try and talk to her and she'd tried to avoid him or something. And Asia wanted to clarify that, no, he never actually knocked on the door. Her husband intercepted him, and he was the one who was relaying conversations. I don't know why they wanted to clarify that. They did. And then they clarified an issue. Again, I'm sure the transcripts will show why. I didn't miss why this was being clarified at this point. That Fear started asking her, when you were talking to Kevin Urich back in 2010, did the issue of you being an alibi ever come up? An alibi witness? And she said, only when I initially called him. I started off saying, I don't know if this has anything to do with me seeing him in the library that day, but you might not know who I am because I never testified. And Theo asked her, so did Urich know about your March 2000 affidavit? And she said, I don't know. And Theo kept pushing this point, trying to show, oh, Kevin Urich could not have engaged in witness tampering because he wouldn't have known who Asia was. And so he told her, so Urich wouldn't have known your role in this case. And Asia responded, maybe Gutierrez told him, I think. I don't know how this works, which is true, because he kept trying to get her to prove or establish points that were just way beyond her knowledge.
Right. But when she just said that when I initially contacted Urich, I said, I don't know if this has anything to do with me seeing him in the library. I mean, that immediately establishes her relevance and the fact that she's a witness.
Yeah, plus we know that Urich testified at the PCR proceeding that Asia told him that she had only written the affidavit due to pressure from the family, which we'll discuss, and we know that that's not true, but that clearly indicates that they discussed her affidavit and the whole story of her seeing Adnan in the library.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even realize that. Of course he knew about it. Of course she told him about it, or else he was just making it up entirely at the hearing. Anyway, this is when the basketball thing comes up again, and Theroux's big point he's working up to deflates. It was confirmed that, well, no, Asia hadn't been playing basketball her senior year. She says that she'd remembered after her testimony yesterday that she'd played her junior year, or I guess maybe sophomore. But she said that I remembered I played with an upperclassman on my team, so it could not have been the senior year. Which explains a lot, because I had never seen Asia's name on a list of players from the senior year. And she just misremembered because it's been 17 years and she played 1 year and didn't know when it was. So Viru seemed to accept that, which made me think he actually had some information about her schedule. I don't know. But he did seem to accept the fact that, no, she hadn't been playing basketball her senior year. So that all went away.
Yeah, we have some of the box scores too, right? We posted them on our website, and she's not listing any of the basketball box scores from 99.
Well, it sounds like she wasn't one of the players that would ever
make that would make
the
sense.
Box scores. So then Theer started asking her about the library, when she called, she'd go in person, talk to a security guard. And she said, I just called the library. Someone there told me there were cameras. That's all I remember. And then he asked, did you call the police? Like you mentioned, you might do in one of your letters. And she said she'd actually picked up the phone at one point and was going to, but then she chickened out and didn't. Then Theer switched and started asking, so what's the name of the jail in your home city on the West Coast? And he just said, I believe it's called a jail. And he dropped that, came back to it later. At this point, it's kind of scattered because his questioning, it was very much foundational. So he was laying all kinds of foundations, many of which he kind of abandoned. But it wasn't really a coherent theme yet because he was trying to lay the backdrop for where he wanted to go in the end. So he was kind of hitting a lot of points all over the place.
Is this a strategy, do you think? I mean, like, is this used sometimes to kind of trip witnesses up, that you touch on something, you leave it, you come back later, instead of going kind of in a chronological or some kind of a pattern fashion?
It made sense as a tactic for where Theroux wanted this to go. It just didn't ultimately go there. Because if you explain everything to the witness question by question as you're going through cross, in theory, they can see where you're going with it and, you know, dodge it. If you ask these questions in disjointed fashion, the idea is that they can't see the traps they're falling into
right
until later on.
So after asking her about whether she knows where the jail is in Spokane, he asked about what happened at the library when she saw Adnan and what did they talk about? And he asks her, what did you talk about in the library? And she responds, We talked about, hey, he said she's dating some white guy now. It's cool. I just want her to be happy. And Theo follows up by asking, don't you find it intriguing that he talked about Hay on the day he was convicted of killing her? Justin objected. The objection was sustained. And the question was rephrased, something like, didn't that seem odd to you if they had broken up, that he's talking about her? And Asia said, well, Adnan seemed similar to my ex, Justin Adger. Adnan acted like Justin had acted when I dumped him.
Yeah, she was just saying it stood out to her because it was it reminded her a lot of Justin's response, and she was impressed by how level-headed he seemed about it all.
Maybe I'm jumping the gun. Maybe this was redirect, but I thought I saw something on social media about how Asia is the one who brought up Hay, not Adnan.
Yep, on redirect. Okay. Because the way Theer was trying to shape it on Cross was as if Adnan had suddenly started bringing up the fact that, oh, Hay had moved on and been dating someone else on the same day that she went missing. And Justin got out on redirect that, well, no, Asia was the one who was asking these questions. And she was like, well, I guess because I knew I had friends of both of them, I was being kind of snoopy and just wanted to know more. So she was the one who started quizzing Adnan about the breakup and about what was going on between them now.
It's interesting because what's happening here is he is kind of covering his bases. On one hand, he's kind of making the argument so far that you're just making all this up and none of this actually ever happened. And on the other hand, now he's saying, well, what was the substance of your conversation? And meaning this actually did happen, but oh goodness, did you find Adnan really suspicious that day?
He definitely flipped back and forth a lot between the two versions. And at least on the credibility front, I think that will work against him because the way Asia was talking about this conversation did seem very natural. A lot of it was stuff she'd never said before or hadn't at least had recorded on Serial. So it did seem like a very natural recounting of a memory. And just the way he was asking the questions did assume that this conversation had existed.
Well, here's my question. I mean, when I'm looking at the next set of notes, I'm trying to figure out what he's exactly trying to do. So next, Theeru asks, I guess a couple of times, would it surprise you that friends said that Hay described him as overprotective? Would it surprise you that friends had expressed concern over his possessiveness? Did you know that she wrote in her diary that he called her a devil? I mean, what is he suddenly trying to make Asia say, oh my gosh, this guy is horrible and I totally recant my testimony? What is he hoping to achieve from this other than just kind of, I just don't see what he can get from those questions in terms of her, the substance of her testimony, which is simply that I was there on that day at that time and saw him.
Yeah, that's exactly my thought process. I have no answers for you. Just the same questions.
Yeah, she's not a character witness. She's an alibi witness. Those types of questions you would ask of a character witness, not in terms of actual materiality of an alibi witness.
And what he was saying wasn't correct either. It was so Justin Brown was objecting, going like, well, asked and answered and asking beyond her knowledge and not truthfully giving facts in his questions, because the questions he was asking her, some were correct, like, oh, did you know that she wrote in her diary that he called her a devil? Well, yes. But then he started saying things about how Hay had described Adnan as jealous in her diary. And that didn't happen. I don't know if he was just making that up or if he was confused somehow, but that's not something in Hay's diary at all. And he was quizzing her about it.
But even where he was accurate that it was written in the diary that he called her a devil, what is the relevance? I mean, I would assume that I would think that Justin would object to just relevance. Like, what is the relevance of this to the purpose of this alibi witness being here? I mean, his objections don't seem to be the kind of objection that makes sense to me, to be honest.
The asked and answered and the misrepresentation of facts, I think, were more serious objections, but didn't really matter what he chose because the judge was not going to sustain it. So this went on for a little bit, and he kept asking her questions about the diary, even though, of course, Asia's like, I have no idea what she wrote in her diary. You can keep asking these questions all day. I'm going to give the same answer every time. And then this is where he started doing the whole criticism against Asia for not doing an independent review of the transcripts and for her failure to independently research the case and just relying on Serial's representations. So eventually he moved on and started going into like more facts about what happened and what happened with Derek. Okay, and at this point, I just realized that I've been mixing up names. Jared, who I think I was saying earlier, is actually not the boyfriend at the time. That was Asia's boyfriend's friend. Her boyfriend's name was Derek. So just assume any time I talked about Jared earlier, I meant Derek. Now on, we'll just say boyfriend and boyfriend's friend. Anyway, Asia said that she remembered the date of when this happened because of what had happened that evening and what happened over the next 2 days. And she said that because of all the ice coming in, there was a lot of concern about the roads. And Asia had been able to use this to convince her parents or her mother to let her stay at her boyfriend's longer I guess while I waited to see how the road conditions would be. And she said that her mother bought it and that the excuse that Asia was giving was believed. And because of that, she'd gotten to stay at her boyfriend's a few hours later. But late that night, he did drop her off because I guess the ice hadn't come in yet. And then we get into the whole ice versus snow debate, where Viru tried to score points on whether or not it had been ice or snow that caused the bad weather. And she said, well, I don't remember the weather so much as the team of stays. The type of weather wasn't important to me. It was just the fact that we were out of school for 2 days due to it. And then he said, is it possible you're mixing up your memory and thinking of a different day? And she very clearly said, no, because I remember missing 2 days of school due to the weather. And he asked her, so your memory is linked to Hay going missing that day and to missing 2 days of school for weather? And she said, no, my memory is linked to using it as an excuse to stay late with my boyfriend. And my mom bought it. And I remember it because there was no school for 2 days. And I was glad about that. I remember 2 days off. And then she started talking about how I remember that on February 9th, or whatever day that we learned of Hay's death, we all try to remember the 13th and the last time we saw Hay. And I think she started crying at this point a little bit. This is where she talked about how she'd recently had another person in her life that she was close to die. And she started saying, well, you know, when someone dies, when someone goes missing, you always try to remember the last time you spoke to them. But I realized I couldn't remember the last time I saw her alive. All I could remember is having a conversation about her in the library the day she went missing. So on the day that I learned of Hay's death, that's when I remembered the conversation with Anon and started thinking about that. And the way she told it was pretty powerful because it did seem, the way she explained it, it made perfect sense to me that she knew that that conversation happened on January 13th because when they all learned of Hay's death, they were sitting around talking about the 13th and talking about when they last saw Hay alive. And she was upset because she couldn't remember. She didn't know when she last saw Hay. She didn't know if she'd seen her on the 13th. All she remembered is on the 13th talking about her. And that's when she started, in her mind, recalling this memory. That's why she knew when she heard of Anon's arrest, oh, that was the day I was talking to him.
And that's helpful, I think, definitely to show that it was much earlier than March 1st, all the way back to whatever it was, February 9th, 10th, or 11th, that she had that recollection. That makes it, in my mind, much more reliable. And then, as you say, her emphasis on the two canceled school days after the fact definitely strongly links that to January 13th and seems, again, pretty credible and something that Judge Welch, I think, will look on favorably.
Rather than going through the testimony, maybe easier just to summarize what Thiru did next, which was a dissection of her two letters. This is when, again, he starts going back to this whole your letters were fabricated offers to forge an alibi. So the first letter, the first one, the handwritten one, here are the lines that he picked out to try and use as proof that letters were fake.
Yes, let's start with the first letter. First, Thiru focused upon the passage in the letter that said, throughout your actions that day, and it seems from Susan's notes that Thiru was trying to argue that Gutierrez might have known Asia and I didn't have class together that day, and therefore this line would seem to be an indication that she's either making a misstatement or a lie.
Yeah, Thiru was trying to say that because Asia's letter says throughout your Y-O-U apostrophe R-E actions that day, this was an indication that she was talking about Anon's actions the entire day of the 13th. But Gutierrez could have known that Anon and Asia didn't have classes together, and therefore this line's a lie, and therefore the alibi is not worth pursuing. And Asia just explained, well, no, I meant throughout his actions in the time I saw him in the library.
And then Thiru looks at this other line. I also called the Woodlawn Public Library, and the implication here seeming to be she mentioned the cameras in her letter on March 1st. How would she have time to call the library between going to Anon's house and writing the letter? And then also, as we'll discuss later, we know Thiru calls the security guard at the library to kind of try to testify. There were no cameras back then. But Susan, we know there are a couple of issues with this line of interrogation by Thiru, right?
Yeah, he said, would it surprise you to learn that the school only got cameras after you'd graduated? And Asia said, yes, it would surprise me. I can only go by what the librarian told me when I asked. And Thiru tried to say, well, your letter doesn't make sense for when you call the library. And she's like, well, I called it that day at some point. I guess if there really hadn't been cameras, he might have scored a point. But it really was kind of a brutal cross-examination, and not for the witness. It's usually the other way around, because so many times Theo tried to land a blow and it just fizzled out or backfired.
Yeah, I mean, that takes us to the next portion of the letter. He focuses on the language. I really would appreciate if you would contact me between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. or 8:45 p.m. until a certain time. And Theo seems to be honing in and asking, what were you doing between 4 and 8:45 p.m.?
He kept trying to be like, oh, you had a basketball game, basketball practice. There's some reason why you weren't available from 4 p.m. to 8:45. And she just said, well, I figure if you're going to tell someone to call you, it's helpful to tell them when the best time to reach you is.
Even if she was unavailable from 4 p.m. to 8:45, that would have no impact on her being at the library at 2:30. I don't see what the point of that was.
Where I think he was going, and I'm not sure if it was really clear, but this is my assumption, is that he was saying, oh, you had an activity in April that kept you busy from 4 to 8:45, but you didn't have this activity in March. I think maybe that's where he was going, but that's one of the ones that definitely went nowhere.
Now, this next one's big because if we go back to Judge Welch's initial opinion denying relief, it was based in part upon the lack of a concrete timeline in Asia's letters. And so Theo focuses upon the line, I will do my best to help you account for some of your unwitnessed, unaccountable lost time from 2:15 to 8 o'clock p.m., and so Theo is, of course, asking Asia, how, at the time of this letter, do you know what time period that Adnan needed to account for?
And like she said earlier, it was the fact that his family had told her that. They said that, you know, we knew he was at school to 2:15 and we knew that he was in mosque at 8. We're trying to piece together what he did between those two times. And the way she explained this one, I don't know if it was at this stage or later on across, was that we have to understand, if he was stayed in the library after I left, if someone else came in and talked to him, well, then he has a really long alibi. And maybe if I can remind him where he was, he'll be like, oh, when Asia left, white girl Stacy came in and I talked to her or something.
For me, this is the whole key aspect of the failure to contact an alibi witness ineffective assistance claim, is that when Gutierrez is shown a letter like this, it is ambiguous. And you can't tell from the letter exactly when she saw him, which is exactly why it was incumbent upon Gutierrez to contact this witness and figure out, okay, what exactly is going on? I do see this long time frame. When exactly did you see him? Because the timeline here, as Sarah Koenig recognized in the episode where she recreated the timeline after school, knowing minute to minute exactly what time could be accounted for was critical in presenting that defense. Then we can move to the last portion of the first letter that Theo hones in on, which says the police have not been notified yet to my knowledge. Maybe it will give your side of the story a partial head start. And basically, Theo is trying to ask Asia whether this could be interpreted as an offer to fabricate an alibi. And then Susan, her response to that is what?
She just kind of said, no, I was just telling him I want him to know the information. And I knew that the police didn't know it yet, so maybe it would give him a head start. He was trying to use it as evidence that she had these bad intentions to help a murderer. But she just said, I was writing to a friend and saying, like, well, I mean, it would have given him a head start because I hadn't told the police yet. That's all it meant.
And she even says in her first letter, I'm not sure whether you're innocent or guilty. And maybe this would be more helpful if I had stayed longer, but I didn't. And so, like, here's what I know. Tell your attorney can follow up and we can figure this out. But it's certainly, the letter does not read as if this is someone unambiguously supporting Adnan and in any way trying to create an alibi. It seems like someone who's very much impartial and they're not sure what happened, but basically they know what they know and they're looking to share that information.
What 17-year-old is subtle enough to fake an alibi for a murder and could also think to have the person faking the alibi express doubt in your innocence? I guess someone could, but you know, it's just a really high-level, complicated scheme that ultimately is never used. I thought one line from the testimony that was very interesting was when he got to the unaccounted time part, he asked her, do you understand that someone might read that line as an offer to create an alibi for Adnan Syed? And she said, yes, but I was 17. And Theeru asked, do you understand someone could interpret it as an offer to cover for him? And she said, I can't be held responsible for someone misreading my letter. And then Theeru asked her about that last line, about the police not being notified. He said, so the police not notified yet. So you were giving him a head start. Do you understand how someone could interpret that as offering help in crafting an alibi? And Asia said, actually, no, I don't understand how it could be read that way. She seemed pretty incredulous about it because the question doesn't make much. I mean, it's a pretty far-fetched reading. And Theeru tried to press her on this and she wouldn't give. She's like, I don't know how you're reading that line to say I'm offering to help create an alibi. Not even the most willful misreading really supports what you're saying.
In all these years when I read those letters, like I actually never read it like that. I just read it the way I think she intended it, which was that I know your unaccounted time is this, and I'm pretty sure I was with you for some of it. But this is not the first time I've seen this particular interpretation, and none of us have. We also have seen this at least for the last year, if not longer, on Reddit. And so this is an argument that I am not at all surprised that the prosecutor tried to make.
My favorite line from Asia's testimony was when Theeru tried like a last attempt to sort of salvage this line of questioning and said, isn't it reasonable to base an interpretation of a letter based on what the letter says? And Asia said, if they want to misread my letter, that's on them, which is perfect because it's true. If the attorney wants to read a letter and just assume it means whatever they happen to assume without checking, that's on them. That's not on Asia. That's not about what she meant or what she would have said. That's why the attorney had a duty to actually investigate.
Yeah, and there's a case directly on point. I've talked about it in my blog. I mentioned it on the podcast, Montgomery versus Peterson. It's a case out of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. It's been cited by the Court of Appeals of Maryland in Henry Paris, the key ineffective assistance alibi case. And it's a case where exactly like this, there was an alibi witness. The defendant told the attorney about the alibi witness. The attorney thought this was a lie, decided not to investigate. And this, in fact, was the 13th alibi witness. 12 alibi witnesses were contacted. The 13th wasn't. And the Seventh Circuit said that was insufficient because you very well might have had a different opinion about the credibility and veracity of this alibi witness if you talked to them. And it's just per se insufficient to rely upon a letter or a receipt, which was the case in Montgomery versus Peterson. You need to talk to that witness and determine, would this be a good witness at trial? You can't make that decision without first talking to the witness.
And at some point around here, Theeru started bringing up this whole school library versus public library issue. And he asked her about when people go to which, and he asked, do you remember using the school library? She said no. And he asked her, did you know that Anon and Hay often went to the school library together? And she said, no, I don't know how they spent their time together. He asked, would it surprise you to learn that Anon's routine was to go to the school library and not the public library? And she's like, well, I wouldn't know what his routine was. But that's not true, as I had in my notes, and it later came out in the hearing. Like, no, that's not true. His routine was to go to the school library during school hours. But we'll get more into that later. Anyway, Theeru started saying, wouldn't it make more sense for Anon to go to the school library if he had track after school? And she offered this. She said, well, track didn't always start down at the track. They would start at the library and meet there, and that's where they begin running from, which I've never heard someone say the library was a place where they'd meet up, but I have heard other students say they did meet at places to start running. So what you're saying did match other students, and it's from her and also from Hamiel, who we'll get into later. It does sound like that members of teams would meet at places like possibly the library or would regularly go to the library before practice. So Theeru asked, any idea why Anon went to the public library that day? And she said, his own prerogative, which got a few laughs. And then, do you understand how it might appear if you usually went to the school library, but then on the day your ex-girlfriend was murdered, you changed your routine and went to the public library instead? And that got probably the best objection of the hearing. Objection, question is compound, confusing, and misleading. It was overruled.
So Asia says, I don't see how this is strange. But then the prosecutor comes back and says, not strange to change routine on the day girlfriend dies. And Asia says, I don't see it as strange. People change their routines all the time. Then he starts going back to parsing her letters. But this time he picks up on the second letter. So he's talking about the second letter, which she had originally apparently handwritten and then typed up. And Asia McLean describes how she wrote it in class. She went home and typed it. She added clip art. And Theeru has a series of questions for her. He says, you wrote it in class, then you went home and typed it. Did you make changes when you typed it? She says, I don't know. It was a handwritten letter, sort of a draft. And he says, you don't say in letter, it's a rough draft. And she answers, no, but it says I'm in class, so you have to assume I'm typing later. And Theo asks, what happened to the draft? And Asia says, I don't know, I threw it away.
All right, so the first portion of the letter that Theo focuses in on deals with the fact that Asia lists Adnan's inmate number of 99200-5477 and then knows the address of the Baltimore City Detention Center where he's being held. And his point is to say, basically, how did you know his inmate number as of March 2nd? And at least from social media, and Susan, maybe you can confirm, what I saw was his claim was that Adnan wasn't moved to Baltimore City Detention Center until weeks after his arrest. Well, we've gone through the files, both the defense files and the MPIA files. And what we know is from the visitor logs, Adnan was given his inmate number, the same one he had throughout his incarceration, the day he was arrested, February 28th. And in terms of the documentation, right there, the very first couple of days of March, he was in the same wing of the BCDC, the Baltimore City Detention Center, that he was in for the rest of his incarceration throughout 99. And so it's very easy to imagine that when she went to Adnan's house, the family told her the inmate number and told her the correct place where he was located. And so really, this seems to me to be a non-issue.
Theo didn't really make a claim so much as he was just kind of throwing doubt out there. He never really actually said what he was trying to allege. Just a little suspicious that she knew this address. But, I mean, she was at his family's house, and the family's going to know how to contact him, if anyone is. And we know this was his number as of the 28th. So it was just this weird, like, aha, I've caught you now. You knew his address. And Asia's not even understanding really why he's trying to use that as proof that she was lying. She just seemed like really confused by this. Or she thought he was asking really obvious questions and didn't realize he was trying to prove something, because the points he was trying to prove, it just didn't go anywhere.
But he was trying to prove, or he was trying to suggest at least, that she wrote that letter later. That letter, even though it's dated on March 2nd, that it was not actually written on March 2nd, that this information that was part of the letter, the address, the inmate numbers, there's no way she could have known that stuff by March 2nd.
But she didn't realize that yet. She didn't know where he was going. So she would just seem like, what is this dude asking me? Because she didn't know that he was trying to argue that she wrote this weeks later. So from her context, like, these questions were just weird, but she did well with them. She just gave very, you know, straightforward, like, well, that's a weird question, but here's actually what happened kind of responses.
All right, so the next portion that Theo focuses in on is the portion where Asia says, I believe in your innocence, and Theo basically asking, well, the night before, as I said before, on the March 1st letter, you said you were uncertain, so how now have you changed to believing in his innocence?
So Asia, in response, says, in between the two letters, I kept thinking about it, and I just had such a hard time reconciling our conversation with him killing her that day. I was going back and forth still, wanted to know more. At school, people were saying, if he's in jail, don't you think they have good reasons? So I wanted to know more about the reasons for the arrest. And then she says, my opinion on his guilt is fluid.
This next portion, I remember addressing on Twitter, and I think that Justin actually presented the newspaper article into evidence, and that is the portion of the letter where Asia says, quote, I know Central Booking. Theo asking, how did you know the name Central Booking? Well, the article on Adnan's arrest from the Baltimore Sun on March 1st indicates that he was taken to Central Booking. So this, again, seems like a non-issue.
If anything, it confirms the date of the letters, because, well, Theo jumps in and says, but wait, you don't even know the name of the jail in your hometown. You've never been arrested. You've never been in jail. How could you know what Central Booking is? And she's like, I guess someone mentioned it to me. But this proves the defense's point. If she had written these letters later, why would she know of Central Booking? That shows contemporaneous timing, because that's the date these articles about Central Booking came out.
Justin makes that point in the redirect, though, right?
Yeah.
But at this point, Asia is not quite sure why she knew Central Booking.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the next portion is Theo asking Asia about the portion where she says or asks, how long did you stay in the library that day to Adnan? And the point he seems to be trying to get across is Asia attempting to line up her story with Adnan's. But that, to me, doesn't seem like what that line means. It seems to me where she's saying, I left before you, and so I'm wondering how much longer you stayed, because that, of course, could be important with the state's timeline. Then Thera asks about the portion of the second letter where she refers to the other day, that other day being Monday, with the second letter being written on Tuesday. And Thera is basically asking her, isn't it odd to refer to the previous day as the other day?
I can only imagine Asia's bewilderment at these questions. I mean, like, well, she's a 17-year-old. I understand what he's trying to do, but obviously we all understand she's 17 years old. I mean, even adults, I've read my portion of adult writing, and it's not always fantastic, even for people who've graduated from grad school. But this is a 17-year-old writing a letter. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, even adults, I know I'll have conversations where someone will be on a Tuesday saying, you know, this Wednesday or next Wednesday. And I'm always, if they say next Wednesday, are they referring to the Wednesday the next week or the next day? And it seems people use different language to describe these types of things. And it doesn't seem at all strange to me that that's the way she referred to it.
I mean, this whole series of questions was just, he would have been much better served by just focusing on a few issues and picking them out and trying to attack those. But this just dissecting of every single line in the letter, including stuff that just, there's nothing there. And his insistence on trying to walk through and find lies in every single line, I think worked against him because Asia was so good and his questions were so stupid that her responses were pretty easy.
I mean, I'm looking at this one note that you made, that one of the questions was that she wrote that Justin's mom is worried about you. And he asked, when would you have possibly had time to talk to Justin's mother? I mean, this is pretty intense. It's literally line by line.
Yeah. I mean, he asked at some point, she wrote in her letter the other day, parentheses Monday, we, parentheses, some of Mr. Parker's class, were talking about it. And Miss Schaub overheard us. She said, don't you think the police have considered everything? They wouldn't just lock him up unless they had real evidence. And he says, well, when did this happen? Could you have had Mr. Parker's class on Monday and Tuesday? Didn't you like switch between A days and B days? How could you have had it 2 days in a row? And Asia was like, well, I don't remember my schedule. And she could have. It's not like every class changed every day. I have no idea if Asia had Spanish Mr. Parker on both A days and B days. And anyway, the letter doesn't say that she was in Mr. Parker's class. It just says that some of Mr. Parker's class were somewhere that the French teacher, Miss Schaub, could overhear. Not that they were actually in Mr. Parker's class. But she mentions Mr. Parker again and says, he seemed unopinionated, yet he seemed happy when I told him I spoke to your family about the matter. And Thera tried to spin this as signs of attention seeking, that she would just wanted to, you know, get the praise of her teacher. And she said, well, no, I mean, I told him about what I'd done and he didn't express an opinion on Nan's guilt or innocence. He just seemed like he was glad that I had stepped up to say what I knew, which, by the way, I only wish all the teachers at Woodlawn had been like Mr. Parker.
I also just wonder, in this whole time frame, we know that the media had reported that Hay was last seen alive at 3. Debbie is at Woodlawn. She's presumably telling people in that circle that she saw Hay at 3 o'clock. So in terms of attention seeking, I would imagine that Asia is just recounting seeing Adnan at the library before 3. So it doesn't seem like she really would have been seeking spotlight as much as just saying, oh, this is kind of interesting. I saw Adnan at the library. He seemed perfectly relaxed and calm. And it was more that than even an alibi, because at that point she had no idea that the time frame she was covering would be important.
And then, of course, Thera also uses this as proof that she was lying, because she didn't tell many people. She didn't go around telling everyone. So Thera was like, well, why wouldn't you tell everyone about it? The fact you only told a few people shows that you weren't really confident in your story, right?
Yeah, you can't have it both ways, right?
So we're just going to go through the lines that Thera basically picked out of the letter and what he was basically implying by kind of asking her about those lines instead of explaining every single answer, because I think her answers are pretty consistent, that mostly it's I don't know and whatever. So these are some of the lines that Thera picks on. Also, you're the most popular guy in school. Shoot, you might get to be prom king. So you weren't just a love-struck girl trying to impress a popular boy? Then he goes to the line, you'll be happy to know the gossip is dead for your associates. It's starting to get old. Your real friends are concentrated on you and your defense. And Thera asks, how could gossip have gotten dead or old in just 2 days?
Actually, Asia did explain that first line about the prom king. I mean, she was joking about the fact that everyone was talking about him because of this and everyone knew who he was. So she's joking, ha ha, you might get prom king. And then about the starting to get old, I mean, she's pointing out that having 2 days of hearing people call your friend a murderer, yeah, that would start to get old.
So then he talks about the line where she says, I want you to know that I'm missing instructions from Mrs. Ogle's CIP class writing this letter. And then he goes back to the CIP first period, second period. And he had talked about that from the first letter, too. And then she has says in her letter, did you cut school that day? Meaning the 13th. Someone told me that you cut school that day to go play video games. So Theo asks, how could you have known that this is what Jay told the police? But of course, Jane actually never told this to the police. Then he moves on to the line, I don't understand how it took the police 3 weeks to find Hayes' car if it was found in the same park. And Theo says, how could you have known it took 3 weeks or that it was found in Lincoln Park? Then there is the line, I don't understand how you would have even known about Lincoln Park or how the police would expect you to follow Hay in your car, kill her and take her to Lincoln Park, dig a grave and find your way home. And Theo asks, how could you know all these facts? It must be from the search warrant. And we'll discuss that in a bit. And then he gets to the line, how come you don't have any markings on your body from Hay's struggle? And he asks, how could you know this? And then she says in her letter, white girl Stacy just mentioned she thinks you did it. Something about your fibers on Hay's body, something like that, evidence. Then Theo asks, how could you know about the fibers? And then she says, anyway, I have to go to third period. And he goes back to that and says, you only had two periods. And she says, I'll write you again, maybe tomorrow. And he says, but you didn't, which we don't know what his point was, but basically he said you didn't. And then lastly, she said in her letter, apparently a bunch of girls were crying for you at the jail, big player, player, ha, ha, ha. And he said, oh, did you want to impress a popular guy?
Yeah, and after each of these points, or most of them, he followed up with a question like, question, is it possible you wrote the letter a month later? Answer, I don't think so. I don't see why I would. Or question, are you sure that the letter wasn't written later? Answer, no, it wouldn't have been. I wrote it on March 1st and 2nd and mailed it shortly after. And then he'd ask, can you see why someone might think a 17-year-old girl would be offering to lie for a popular boy? And she told him, well, no, I was writing the letters for Anon. I didn't think anyone but him would read them, except for maybe someone checking it for razor blades at the jail. I wrote it imagining him laughing at the letter. I mean, the whole thing is a joke. And she points to some of the joking lines, like big playa playa, ha ha ha. She was writing to a friend and hoping to cheer him up in jail. And she said, why would Gutierrez have ever read this letter? I just thought I'd alert Anon and she'd contact me, not that she'd get my letters. And then again, Theory would cut her off and say, are you sure the letter wasn't written later?
Was Justin objecting to this repeated question about
writing? He did for a while. And then he kind of gave up. So he probably had to ask, are you sure it wasn't written later? I want to say minimum 5 times.
But I think it would be good to talk about like these details that he does discuss, which are like the fibers and if Hay struggled and where the car was and how long it took to find the car and how she would have known any of this on March 2nd.
Yeah. Theo had this theory that it was all taken from the affidavits in support of the search warrants that were served on Anon or his family on March 10th, March 9th for his car, and then again on March 20th for his house. And he's like, all these details, you stole them from the search warrant, which you couldn't have known on March 2nd. The thing is, though, that's all bogus because there's exactly one fact that's common between the letters and the search warrant affidavits. And that's that Hay was buried in Lincoln Park. That's it. That's the only fact in common between the two. And if he's trying to argue that Asia could only have learned where Hay was buried from the search warrants, good luck. I mean, this whole thing is kind of a joke because he's out there flashing around the search warrant being like, look at all these details you know. How would you know about the fibers found in Hay's body? Well, that's not in the search warrant. I hope the judge at least reads the search warrant and sees that there is no basis for any of that line of questioning that Theo is putting out there.
Well, plus, a lot of this is just wrong. Like the comment about white girl Stacy saying something about your fibers in Hay's body. We know that there were no fibers that were matched to Adnan or his clothes that were found in Hay's body. So, I mean, this is just the hearsay mill at the high school and rumors being tossed about. This isn't actual valid information. It's just people speculating. And he's just commenting on that speculation, not based on any concrete evidence, but just based upon what people are saying.
And we know at least 4 Woodlawn students had been interviewed by the time Asia's second letter was written. Debbie, Anne, Aisha, and Krista. And because the cops were throwing out facts in these interviews, I mean, that's a lot of sources for rumors to start getting around.
Debbie mentions it in her March 26th interview that I believe one of the sergeants at the school had told Anne about a bunch of evidence in the case and fingerprints were brought up. Now, of course, we don't have any notes or transcripts from these interviews. They took place on March 2nd, the ones for Aisha, Debbie, and Anne. But yeah, I mean, it's easy to imagine that some kernel of information was passed along, got passed around the school, and yeah, it's coming to Asia, and she's saying, oh, here's what people are speculating.
Yeah, Theo even tried to ding Asia on the fact that one of her letters mentions talking to Adnan's friend, Imran. And he asked, but you didn't have any classes with Imran, so when could you have talked to him? Really? Everyone in that whole room knows what it's like being a teenager and being in high school, and you don't have to be in a class with someone to gossip with them.
I mean, you don't even have to be in high school. I mean, like, something like this happens, anybody with any information from anywhere is going to be the most sought out person in that group. You know, I can imagine, like, the people who had the interviews with the cops, you know, I'm sure other students were asking, like, what did they say? What did you say? What do you know? And it's just, this is a major, major event for a high school, for something like this to happen. You know, first one of the classmates is murdered and then another one is arrested. And I can't even imagine anything was happening in terms of studies for those few days other than talk about all of this.
Yeah. So Theo started, like, being really aggressive, and he turns from his, oh, let's just discuss why you have the wrong date kind of tone to his, you're trying to pull a fast one on the court kind of tone. And he asks her, talking about when she describes, I don't understand how you could have known about Linkin Park or followed Hay in the car. And he asks her, you put all this together? You put all these facts together by yourself? And she said, yes, here's what I was thinking. I mean, we know that Hay's car was found in Linkin Park. And by the way, listen to the very beginning of episode 15. If you want to hear the TV news clip that explains why Asia thought that. And she says, I didn't understand if they both left in separate cars, which what the police were saying made it seem like had to have happened. How did he follow her, kill her, get her to Linkin Park? She was just describing what she put together logically and doesn't actually match the crime at all. And Theory is trying to use it as evidence that she knew more than she should have. And he says, how did you know about the burial in Linkin Park? And this is where Asia started to cry on the stand, which I know got mentioned on the Twitter feed. It was when she was answering, because when they were telling us about her death, they told us about all of that. And I don't even think it was, I mean, I think I saw speculation that was because Theo's really aggressive tone that was making her cry. But to me, it came off like she was talking about what she'd learned, what happened on the day that the students were all told of Hay's death. That's when she started crying.
But it was reported in the local news the day after Hay's body was found that that's where it was found. It was found in Lincoln Park. You know, what's interesting to me is hearing the juxtaposition of her thinking this through, you know, the two-car problem for Adnan versus how Jay keeps forgetting that they're in two cars in his police interviews.
Yeah. So this is what it's all going towards. Theo has one more question I have to ask. Are you sure you don't remember someone giving you information and you writing this letter weeks later? Answer, yes, I'm sure. This is when we get to the point, quote unquote. Theo asks, did you get any requests to type your letter up? Answer, no. Question, do you have any explanation why on April 9th, 1999, Anand's friend Juwan told police, defendant wrote me a letter. He called yesterday, but I wasn't home. Wrote defendant back. He wrote a letter to girl to type up with his address on it. She got it wrong. 101 East Eager Street, Asia, (12th grade. I got one. Justin Adra got one. Justin was in English class. Goes on. And Asia responded, someone said I received a letter? No, I didn't. And this is the, as Justin later called it, ironically, the smoking gun. He's referring to some notes in the police file that were taken on April 7th or 8th, that time period. And they're unclear what they're referring to because the police didn't really elaborate on it much. But according to Theo, these little notes here are proof that this was all part of a conspiracy to craft a fake alibi for Anand. That's where we're going to. All this buildup, that's where it was heading.
For me, the fundamental problem at the heart of Theo's theory is the March 1st letter. It seems this entire interrogation is about trying to establish that this March 2nd letter might have been written later, that there might have been some tampering, and I don't see it. I don't think Judge Welch would see it, but that still leaves the March 1st letter, and it still leaves Asia being someone who was not a very close friend to Adnan. And whatever you might think about the March 2nd letter, we have this March 1st letter with Asia coming forward and saying, I saw Adnan in the library. And again, keep in mind, This is at a time when it was believed that Adnan would have killed Hay after 3 o'clock, because Debbie is saying she saw Hay at school at 3 o'clock. So what is the explanation for Asia going to Adnan's house, writing that March 1st letter, and just completely making that up? There's no explanation. Again, the judge could find issues with the March 2nd letter. I don't see it. Possibly he could, but that still leaves that March 1st letter as this firewall that I think there's no real way to challenge that and to challenge this story of Asia's alibi.
Even if she hadn't known what Debbie had said at that point, I mean, the news reports were saying that Hay was last seen at 3 p.m. driving away from school.
I don't even think he can make a point in the March 2nd letter. I mean, the problem with Theo's whole theory is that it's insane. And spoiler warning, that evening, of course, the defense is like, well, they actually did go this route with Jawan. I suspect that they believed that it was too stupid of a theory for the prosecution to actually try and use. So when he did use it, they're like, well, let's call Jawan and get him to explain that's bogus. Because it is bogus, and it wasn't at all what Jawan was telling them. And we know that as well, because guess what? The police did interview Jawan again and recorded it, and they never mentioned this. And everyone in the courtroom is going to know, the judge is going to know, that if Jawan had said what Theo was suggesting, the cops would have been all over it. They would have extensively questioned him, got on the record, made actual notes instead of vague sort of allusions. If they thought they had a defendant who was trying to create a fake alibi or trying to request people to write up letters, and they didn't. What Jawan's referring to is the bail letters and the fact that the students were requested. They had little written little sheet thingies handed out that said, please type up a letter asking the judge to grant a non-bail or in support of him being granted bail. Although I do actually wonder if the police knew something about the Asia letters, because as we'll talk about more later, the mail is scrutinized going in and out of jail. I mean, if the police learned that someone was writing letters to Adnan giving him an alibi, it's not surprising to think that they might have followed up on that, which could have been what they were asking Jawan about. And I will say, I've asked people to try and explain what the heck Theory was trying to get at, what his whole theory is. And exactly one person, thank you, Anne, has actually tried to piece a theory together based on what conspiracy Theory was alleging. And it was a very valiant attempt, but it can't be done because here's the point. Why would Asia backdate the letter? What advantage could that possibly have to the scheme? What is the purpose of that? And why, if she was backdating a letter, would she have written the letter she wrote? It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't help anything. Sure, it sounds great to be like, oh, she backdated the letters. That's proof, but it doesn't serve the conspiracy. It doesn't serve any purpose.
I kept wondering about that. I mean, like, if Asia wrote, she already wrote a March 1st letter. If she wrote another letter, let's say mid-April, like basically saying the same thing she said on March, like it doesn't reduce its credibility for any reason that it's been 6 weeks. In fact, it probably makes it even more credible that, hey, I still remember this. What are you suggesting, prosecutor, by saying that she backdated it? Like, why is that nefarious? I don't understand.
He never explained it. And then he kind of backtracks, trying to argue later that the defense did investigate Asia's letters on March 3rd. Okay, so how are you alleging that, one, the defense did investigate Asia's letters on March 3rd, so therefore there's no IAC, and two, Asia actually forged her letters after March 3rd, so there's no IAC because the letters were clearly a fake that the attorney did not have to investigate? You cannot put the two together. Those two theories, which he was presenting at the same time, are mutually exclusive. And again, there's no reason for her to lie about the date of the letter. It makes no sense whatsoever.
I mean, maybe he's not trying to get to the substance of what this implies. Maybe he's just trying to create this, like, you know, this person cannot be believed, right? Like, it doesn't matter that there was no utility to that. It doesn't matter that it wouldn't have helped to backdate it. But the point is, what I'm trying to show to the court is that this woman can't be believed. Maybe that's what his purpose was.
But here's the thing. That doesn't work either, because the Jawan notes weren't in her possession. Because the state, even though it had an obligation to hand over Brady material and Jinx material, never actually did with these notes. So the notes that the Jawan stuff comes from, it's a set of notes that were never given to the defense. And they should have been, most of them should have been, because they were either Brady in some cases, or in other cases, they were Jinx material that they had an obligation to hand over after that witness testified. Never did. So What the prosecution is arguing here is that based on notes it, in many cases, wrongfully withheld, and the defense did not have, the defense should have known that the alibi was not a correct alibi, and therefore they're justified in never contacting her. But I thought he was on more solid ground, kind of, trying to argue that Asia was strategically not contacted because Gutierrez wanted to go with this 3 p.m. theory, therefore Asia doesn't. But here's the thing. If Asia had come in as a credible witness, which she would have, we know now, the state would have had a hard choice. We know there are two possible calls that could have been the come and get me call, 236 or 315. You know, if Jay's story has a spine, that's the spine. One of those two calls is the call. So again, if Asia is deemed credible, which the PCR hearing strongly suggests she would have been, the 236 call is out. That's done. Which means Jay will have to survive on cross a story that involves only a 3:15 p.m. timeline if Asia is there, which is why Theroux's whole argument about Asia not being an alibi drives me insane, because that's the whole point of an alibi. You take away options from the state. The state doesn't want to have a timeline. The state wants to be able to claim that all this happened in some sort of blurry ether and you can't pin it down, so you can't challenge it. But the state can't just shift its timeline. If you prove a time point, then you force the state to put on a different proof. You force them to put on a certain case, which you can then dismantle. And that's what didn't happen here. What happened in Anand's trial, it's hard to pin down a moving target. When you have like a wishy-washy timeline, it can kind of slither all around. It kind of reminds me of the phrase, the God of the gaps, in that Jay's testimony was the testimony of the gaps, so to speak. His story just fills all possible spaces that have not been specifically disproven, which is why the alibi was so crucial here, because she could disprove one version and force Jay to survive explaining this 3:15 timeline the state claims it could have used. And Colin, I know you've discussed this. Why would that have been an issue?
Yeah, well, we have Inez Butler now. Of course, we know since trial that she likely had the wrong day, but she's saying, I saw between 2:15 and 2:20, hey, saying she had to leave school in a hurry and leaving school in a hurry. So how is she still at school at 3? Becky, right after school, said she saw, hey, saying she had somewhere else to be right after 2:15. We know Debbie's story at 3 o'clock, even if assuming we're going with Debbie's story, has issues. One story, she says, hey, at 3 was going to see Don. The other story, she's saying the care is asking for a ride, and Hayes saying she has no time to give anyone a ride. We know that Jay's story is that after he got the Best Buy call, he drives to Best Buy. Adnan shows him the body. They drive out to the park and ride. They move some stuff around in the car. They drive up to the Forest Park golf course. Well, the Nisha call. We know the Nisha call was an integral part of the state's case. If the Best Buy call is 3:15, there's just no possible way whatsoever that the Nisha call could be part of the state's case. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's several other reasons why a 3:15 call simply doesn't work, including the ping. The cell tower that is pinged, and this is, you know, obviously a case where we have issues with cell tower pings, but clearly the state relied upon those pings at trial, and the 3:15 ping does not work where Jay said he was when he received the Best Buy call. So many issues that would have been created if the state tried to shift to that timeline at trial.
Plus, there's Jin to deal with, because there's a call to Jin at 3:21 p.m. And at the time that Jay says he got the come and get me call, he says he's 5 minutes away from Best Buy. So if 3:15 is come and get me call, I mean, on cross, I would want Jay to explain this. At the same moment you're pulling into the Best Buy to pick up Anand from the murder, you're on the phone with Jin. What are you talking to her about? Because under his new timeline that Asia would force him to adopt, he is talking to Jin as he rolls up to the Best Buy.
And Jay's story is that that 3:21 call was calling Jin to see where Patrick was so they could score some weed, which if that is still the story, I mean, we're assuming, right, that he wasn't perjuring himself, which I guess isn't a safe assumption. But in terms of selling that narrative to the jury, assuming he tells that story, T gets the Best Buy call, he pulls up to Best Buy and, you know, okay, he's about to see the body in the trunk and he's asking Jen, well, can I score some weed from Patrick? It doesn't really make that much sense.
Yeah, so Theroux has this whole argument about how Asia was never an alibi in the first place because because of reasons. Because what? Because the state could have claimed she died another time? I mean, it's like he's assuming the state gets the benefit of the doubt to assume that it has the power to change the timeline and everything magically works out.
I think he's actually admitting to something here, which is that he recognizes, I mean, and I remember in the closing, he talked about wrinkles. And even in their brief, you know, in the last two briefs, I think they filed, they talked about how if the state wanted, they could have shifted the timeline. And you know what? They actually could and did, because what happened at trial was, even though Jay kept saying that this was a come and get me call at 2:36, I went and left and got Adnan. At the same time, him and Jen are testifying that he didn't leave her house till like 3:40. I mean, they were able to get away with all kinds of fluctuations in this story.
Because he had the benefit of the multiverse. There was nothing to pin him down. That's why they did that.
So the prosecutor here is actually admitting that we could have gotten away with pretty much anything we wanted to say.
Yeah, and let's bring in the law here. There are basically two key on-point jurisdictional cases. One is Inri Paris W., Court of Appeals of Maryland case. There's an alibi witness who sees the defendant about 30 or 40 minutes away from the scene of an assault. And in finding ineffective assistance of counsel based upon failing to call that alibi witness, the court notes the time of the assault was uncertain. And what that means is, because that alibi witness would defeat at least one version of the timeline, that's enough to prove prejudice and to give a new trial. So a flexible timeline hurts the state and it helps the defendant. The second case is the Griffin case. That was a robbery slash shooting at a Rite Aid, and it was originating in the same court handling Adnan's current appeal. And that's a case where at trial, the state's timeline was, at least under one version, that robbery didn't end until about 3:55 p.m. And the alibi witness who wasn't contacted lived about 3 miles away from the Rite Aid and said the defendant arrived at her place at 4:00. And basically, the defense's claim was this is an alibi because there's no way he could have committed the robbery and been in her house 5 minutes later. And the state on appeal claimed, well, actually, there was some uncertainty and we could have claimed the robbery was done at 3:45 p.m. And what that means is actually that places him within 3 miles of the house, and then therefore the alibi actually hurts him. And of course, the Fourth Circuit said no. The point isn't that an alibi has to defeat every possible timeline. If it defeats a viable timeline the state presented at trial, that's enough to prove prejudice. So those are the two key cases, and they're in Maryland. They're Maryland cases, both saying the exact argument being made by Thero is not only insufficient to defeat a claim of ineffective assistance, but actually the timeline being flexible bolsters the claim of ineffective assistance.
Rabia, you were at the closing at least. What do you think of Thero's argument that it was dangerous to have Asia talk and that it was dangerous for Asia to testify for the defense?
It took me a couple minutes to wrap my head around what he was saying. I was just bewildered because he should know that there were two trials, right? I mean, the first trial established the state's theory of the case. They already had Jay testify at the first trial that 2:36 was the come and get me call. So even if you're going to make this odd argument that, you know, Asia would have been detrimental to the defense because she could have established that maybe she was with Adnan around 2:30, and then after that, Hay left school around 3 and Adnan intercepted her because the library was located in a place that the car would pass by. I mean, none of that matters after the first trial. Even if you want to make that argument, which is a really ridiculous argument, there's no way that's sustainable after the first trial. And Gutierrez had over a month to contact Asia after the first trial because she knew exactly what the state was going to say.
Yeah, and going back to the law and the Griffin case, another alibi witness who defense counsel failed to contact in that case, he was literally picked out of a photo array by one of the security guards at the Rite Aid as one of the perpetrators of the robbery. It's hard to imagine an alibi witness potentially more detrimental than someone picked out of a photo array by one of the victims of the crime. And in that case, the Fourth Circuit said it doesn't matter because, again, the decision being made there, as here, was not, I contacted the alibi witness, I recognized the potential danger, and I decided reasonably not to call them. In both cases, the problem was defense counsel never contacted the alibi witness. And you can't make that decision again, even assuming there's a possibility Asia could have been detrimental, you can't make that decision that she is detrimental without contacting her, talking to her, and figuring out what exactly she would say and how that fits into your narrative and the state's narrative.
Yeah, so, I mean, Justin knew on cross that there had been a lot of stuff thrown out with no basis whatsoever, just thrown out there, used to try and impeach Asia, and he moved on. And he didn't rise to the bait. Rather than chase after each and one of those random asides, he just picked out a few just to make sure the judge knew. Just because we heard Theo say it just now doesn't mean it's true. He'd start off by saying, you were just asked about the conversation in the library and how strange it was that Adnan discussed Hay. But wasn't it you that initiated it? And she said, yeah, that was all me. Because we had mutual friends, I started quizzing him about the breakup. Then he moves on to the forged alibi argument. And he points out that on March 1st, when Asia was at the house, she would have been able to find out his address then. Talks about the rumors going around. And then he puts up a Baltimore Sun article that says Anand Syed was arrested and taken to central booking. And this is where Justin got super dramatic and was like, how could someone have known the word central booking? Are you telling me that you knew the word central booking? How could you have possibly have known that? He kind of oversold it, but it was funny. I mean, because it says that right there, black and white, central booking. And it kind of went on like that for a little bit, just pointing out a few things, you know, like other facts from the letters. They are just on the news. He didn't even hit them all because he didn't need to. And then on recross, Theo said, this is the first time I have heard about your second letter being typed at home after you handwrote it at school. Answer, yes. And that was because I realized that Theo was pissed that he probably did have a class schedule for Asia or something, because he was trying to show that Asia's second letter has knowledge about things that happened both in the morning and the afternoon, or early in the morning and later in the morning. So clearly it couldn't have been real. But as she said, it was a typed up letter. Of course I'm not writing it in class. I typed it later. The fact that it has knowledge from the whole morning doesn't mean anything. And Theory was pointing out, well, I didn't know this before today. So I guess trying to imply maybe it was a new argument or a new claim she was raising. But she never knew before today that Theory was going to try and argue that she backdated her letter. So,
but it's almost like he's implying that this was hidden from him somehow, right? Is that what's going on here? I'm trying to understand why he's angry. But then Justin comes back and redirects, right?
Yeah.
So Justin asks Asia, did Theo ever contact you to talk to you about what you knew? And she answers, no. My attorney contacted him and told him I would make myself available to speak to him, but never heard from him. So she's basically trying to counter this idea that, like, she just jumped him with this information. And then there is a re-cross question from Theo, which I just think is kind of hilarious. And Theo asks, he comes back and he asks Asia, isn't it true the last time you spoke to a prosecutor, you issued an affidavit calling him a liar? Did she just not respond to that?
I don't think she did. Or maybe she just said, I guess, or I don't remember what she said, but it was like a very, and it was such a, it was not a planned question. It was an off the cuff, snotty response, which I'm sure he regretted the second he said it.
Yeah, I'm sure you were too stunned to record Asia's response at that point, because it's just,
well, the court said any further redirect, and Justin said, Your Honor, as tempted as I am to follow up on that remark. And I was talking to Chris Floor later, and he pointed out, like, this just says it all. This is not about the truth for them. This is not about facts. It's not about learning what happened. It's about circling the wagons and trying to win a case at all costs, because if he cared about the truth, he would have talked to Asia. He would have had an investigator reach out to Asia if he was that terrified of her calling him a liar. But just to refuse to talk to a critical witness in a hearing, and you don't want to hear what they say when they're offering to talk to you, because she never even called him a liar. She just said that she never told him the things that he said to the court she'd said. And I think this says a lot.
It does. And it's also one way to avoid getting pinned down. Right. I mean, if he doesn't talk to her, then he can't be pinned down in something he said to her. Now, he did have a whole year to contact her, because her affidavit was filed more than a year before this hearing.
And it's interesting, because isn't this sort of a microcosm of this whole case, in the sense that here we have Theo and he has read the letters and made certain assumptions and certain conclusions based on the letters. He doesn't contact her, and therefore he fails to glean that, in fact, there's more there than it's in the letters. And it's the exact same thing that happened with Gutierrez. she was shown the letters. They told a certain story. It was an incomplete story. And therefore, again, it was incumbent on her to contact Asia McClain. That's why we have this requirement that once a defense is told about an alibi witness, they have to investigate and contact that witness to determine what exactly is their story, how credible do they appear, how does that witness fit into our case, how can they be used against the prosecution case. And just as Gutierrez failed to do that, Theroux failed to do that, and therefore many of his lines of questioning just fell flat.
I waited anxiously to hear about how Asia did on the stand. I could see online from Twitter that she was really being pressed, even to tears. And frankly, I was worried about her. Not worried so much about the integrity of her testimony, because on that, I was certain that she was a rock. She had come forward when she realized she had been misrepresented in a court of law by an officer of the law. She has never had any skin in this game and only done what's best to do what's right. Even when she reached out to Urich, she thought she was doing what was right. This sense of doing right by others is what brought her all the way to Baltimore all these years later. My real worry was that, having gone to such tremendous efforts to do what's right, that Asia was not mistreated on the stand. So I waited anxiously for everybody to come out, but because of my sequestration, of course, nobody was allowed to tell me the substance of her testimony on Director Cross. But what I did ask from everyone was to either give me a thumbs up or thumbs down. Across the board, I got big smiles and all thumbs up. Now remember, while Asia traveled across the country to give her testimony, Urich, who lives one county over, failed to travel 30 minutes to challenge her. When we get to closing arguments, we'll talk about how vehemently Theroux defended his absent colleague, Urich. But as far as I'm concerned, by not calling Urich to rebut Asia, the prosecution essentially admitted that he couldn't rebut her. And that's a double-edged sword for me, because on one hand, I feel a sense of disgusted validation, because we all know why, pathetically, they couldn't afford to put Urich on the stand. But on the other hand, I feel really, really pissed off, because you know what? He should take the stand again and be forced to explain to the exact same judge why he lied in court in October of 2013. Nonetheless, there was no Urich. Asia's testimony stood alone, unchallenged. But it wasn't enough for Adnan's defense team to produce Asia. They took it a step further. They set out to corroborate Asia's statements with a new witness and then prove that if she had been called by Gutierrez, Asia would have changed the course of Adnan's trial. Next time on Undisclosed. Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoy. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer, and you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.